me contrast, I'm finally going to use the whiteboard. I'm going to use the right marker. Let me contrast two different theories of persuasion. Okay? The first is sort of the rational theory or the intellectual theory. Okay? It starts with information. The information changes your attitudes. The change in attitude leads to a change in behavior. This is what you know professors believe in. This is what health departments often believe in, at least when they start. And there are lots of problems. Okay? One problem is people tend to ignore or misperceive or misremember information that conflicts with their attitudes. Another problem is if you absorb information that conflicts with your attitudes, you're very likely to absorb that information independent of your attitudes, and you become a still thinker, capable of saying, well, yeah, but I still think. Despite, you know, yeah, I know it's the same vaccine, but I still think it's dangerous. If a successful attempt to change your attitudes happens, there's far from a guarantee that that will lead to a change in behavior. People routinely store their attitudes and their behavior in different parts of their brain. And we're shockingly comfortable doing things that are incompatible with our attitudes. We'll ignore that conflict if we have to. If we're forced to come to grips with that conflict, if somebody says, look, what you're doing is incompatible with your expressed values, what will you change? We're much more deeply committed to our behavior than to our values. We'll ignore the conflict if we can and hold on to the values and the behavior. If forced to notice the conflict, we will change the values instead of behavior. Years ago, when I was a grad student, I was a research assistant to an effort to improve teaching. And we went to professors and we asked them, what are the goals of the course? And then we designed instruments to measure their success in accomplishing their goals. And we fed that information back to them, figuring that they would change the course to match their goals. What they did is change their goals to match the course. You know, because our commitment to behavior is much higher than our commitment to attitude. So, the rational model doesn't work very well. In contrast to that, here's an irrelevant motivator. Triggering a need and leading to a change in behavior. Smoke new course to get the pretty girl and the handsome guy in the expensive convertible next to the Sylvan stream. Okay. Did it for me. When I was a kid, got me smoking new course. This one works. This one doesn't. Are you with me so far? Now, this one has a problem, however. When you are doing a behavior with no attitude support, okay, you've got this behavior, but it doesn't make sense even to you. It's being triggered by needs that you know are irrelevant. You are likely to feel some discomfort. That discomfort has a name. Anybody know what that discomfort is called? A feeling you have when you're doing something that doesn't make sense even to you. You studied it in your intro psych course. Who said it? Yeah, oh, several of you. Good. Cognitive dissonance. You got it. Leon Festinger is the inventor of this theory and did the initial research. Festinger found, for example, that, well, I'll say that until I've explained it a little bit more. You feel this discomfort. Now, as a result of that discomfort, one of the things you can do is look for information to make sense out of behavior. So you do information seeking. But it is biased information seeking. You are trying to make the dissonance less. You don't want to make the dissonance more. So, now I can talk about the Festinger study. Festinger found, for example, that people read more automobile ads the week after they buy a car than they do the week before they buy a car. But they read different ads. The week before you buy a car, you're reading the ads for the cars you're considering buying. What changes after you buy a car? You want to think you have the right one. So you read ads for the car you bought. And you work very hard not to see any ads for the car you almost bought. Because you are looking to reduce the dissonance. This is, by the way, the real purpose of owner's manuals. Is dissonance reduction. Owner's manuals get 90% of their readership in the first week. By people who are reading the manual, and they think what they're trying to do is become familiar with the car, but what they're actually trying to do is to get some peace about this decision, which was largely need-motivated and about which they're feeling considerable cognitive dissonance. Now, this is the link between the two models, because if you now provide information, then now this information, instead of challenging a behavior, okay, is supporting a new behavior. Everybody see that? This model by itself, you're telling people to change their behavior. This entire model, by the time you get to the information, you're telling people things that support their behavior. The new behavior that was motivated by needs. So some of the early research I did on this was on recycling. And this was in the days before there were recycling centers or government-run recycling programs, and you had to bring your stuff in. Some of you remember those days? You had to bring your newspapers and bottles and cans and whatnot to the recycling center. And we were trying to persuade people to use the recycling center. And it was very clear that information about waste, resource scarcity and waste management was not going to be terribly useful. People were not going to start recycling because they cared about that stuff. At least we weren't going to persuade people who didn't care about that stuff to start to care about it and therefore start recycling. So we decided, all right, we'll use needs. What needs do you think work best? Where it's 1970 and you're in Ann Arbor, Michigan. What needs are going to work really well to get people to recycle? Any guesses?
Need to belong.
Need to belong, not bad. We could have used that one.
It's for the children. For the children.
For the children, yes. Actually, not only for the children, we went into the schools and we persuaded kids that, their parents were evil if they didn't recycle. And we had, this is what Seatbelt Campaign did as well. The largest single group of people who started wearing seatbelts because their kid throws a tantrum every time they pull out of the driveway without putting on a seatbelt. Then they became a habit. They started believing in it, same process. We did the same thing with the recycling station. It was like, you're recycling on weekends in order to look like a decent parent. You don't want to look like an idiot, like a jerk to your kid. That was reason number one. What was reason number two?
Save the planet.
It's a little embarrassing to tell you this, but this is science after all. We staffed the recycling station with young college students, female, who we didn't have to tell them not to wear bras, they just weren't. And this is the only chore that men would rather do than have their wives do. The men said, no, honey, I'll go to the recycling station. It was very clear that sexuality and not wanting to look like a jerk to your kids and wanting to see whatever you could see as they helped you take the crap out of your car, those were the two dominant reasons why people started recycling. But they started recycling, and then they wondered, they didn't want to say, I'm doing this in order not to look like a jerk to my kid and in order to get to see some boobs. They didn't feel like a good enough reason. So they started saying to themselves, I wonder if there are any good reasons for recycling. And we had information available at the recycling station about saving the planet, about waste management and landfill capacity and resource recovery and all of the things. And what we found, and it shouldn't surprise you, is people are enormously likelier to read that stuff after they start recycling than before they start recycling. That kind of information doesn't get you to recycle. It gets you to understand why you recycle. So they acquired the information. The information built stable attitudes. The attitudes rationalized the behavior. And one of the differences between this behavior and this behavior is this behavior depends on the need. If you don't keep triggering the need because cognitive dissonance is a downer, the behavior extinguishes. So you have to either keep repeating the message, keep triggering the need, or the behavior is going to die. By contrast, this behavior is stable because now it has attitude support. It's not only stable, it's generalizable. Now that I have some attitudes about saving the planet, one of the interesting differences we found is early recyclers who were still need motivated were pissed when Ann Arbor established a municipal recycling program and it was going to be picked up at your house. They tended to vote against the returnable bottles law. Because those things interfered with their fondness for recycling. Okay? Recycling the way they were doing it. But this group supported returnable bottles. This group supported the municipal recycling program because now they had attitudes, and the attitudes were generalizable to other behaviors not linked to the need. Does this make sense to you? I took much more time on this than I'm taking on anything else, partly to justify having the whiteboard. but also because this, in many ways, this is the keys to the kingdom. This is by no means all there is to persuasion theory, but this is my favorite hook of it. And I'm hoping that your mind is buzzing with health applications. That you can see lots of opportunities to get people to do something for stupid reasons and then giving them good reasons for what they're doing. And, I want to stress, stupid reasons isn't only possible, it's necessary to the success of the model. If the need is relevant, there'll be no dissonance. If there's no dissonance, there's no information seeking. If there's no information seeking, there's no attitude development. So not only is it possible for the motivator to be irrelevant, it's important for the motivator to be irrelevant because you want to use the dissonance to build attitudinal support. Any questions? Yes, sir.
Well, isn't it possible then to use a rational motivator and skip the whole dissonance step?
Yes, except the rational motivator, I mean, if you use an attitude that's not a need at all, you're not going to get much of behavior because this by itself tends not to work. If this is connected enough not to arouse dissonance, but not cognitive, okay, then you're not getting where you want to get. You want to get to where it's generalizable, you want to get to where it's cognitive, you want to get to where it's information-based, where it's, I hate to use the phrase, sound science. I have trouble saying that without sounding sarcastic. And you can't get to any of those places if the need feels like a good enough reason to do it. If I feel like, I did it because of the need, no problem, it's a perfectly good reason to do it, then it's stable. It's not going to extinguish, but it's not going to move on either. And you're not going to get something that's cognitive and generalized. Yes?
I wish we could take you back to our local health units and our state health units, because this just flies in the face of what our doc, and I love, I'm with it, but it flies in the face of what our docs and others want to do. I mean, their thing is try to inform the public, and give them the data, and then they're going to just get it.
Yep.
And
I know.
It really is a lot, I don't know how to convince. I come from an advertising background too, and always tell to say sell the sizzle and not the steak. But to try to explain this idea, but they still want to. It's all steak.
I, It will help you deal with them to understand that their commitment to keeping their messages scientific and technical and, you know, and grounded in sound science, that commitment is not grounded in sound science. They have a strong emotional commitment to not being emotional. And, you know, as long as, you know, I mean, you know, this will give you some of the science behind why they're wrong, but what you really need to do is do outrage management about their outrage at the fact that the world doesn't work the way they want. You have to do internal outrage management on behalf of decent precaution advocacy. Okay. Do you see why? Because it's, you know, for many scientists, it's a source of great outrage that God screwed up and made people this way. You know, and you know, so, and they're not thinking straight. And they'll, you know, and you know, you can tie them off in knots by saying the science says that science doesn't do any good, and that you score rhetorical points that way, but you don't win them over. You win them over by addressing their outrage at the fact that science doesn't work because, damn it, it should work. But it doesn't. And you happen to have to do outrage management. Other comments? How long do I have?
13 minutes.
Oh, good. I can cover something else. Okay. Number 7 is appeal to emotions. You know, next to needs, emotions are your second best shot. Now, the emotion that's most obviously relevant to precaution taking is usually fear, but it's not always the best emotion to arouse. You know, nonetheless, you know, fear is a good one, and I certainly don't want to take fear off the table. I have lots of clients who do want to take fear off the table, who I think I mentioned earlier, who want to say, you know, I want people to take precautions, but I don't want to scare them. And, you know, what Jody and I have called in some of our writing, fear of fear is extremely widespread. And another opportunity for you to do internal outrage management, at, you know, in order to reduce people's fear of fear. But in fact, fear is a good one. Fear has had, as you probably know, it has had a bad press. You know, but the evidence is very strong that fear appeals work. There are a couple of qualifiers. Fear appeals do not work if people are in denial. If people are in denial, fear appeals backfire. Okay? Frightening the apathetic works. Frightening people in denial pushes them more deeply into denial. That's the first qualifier. The second qualifier is fear appeals do tend to extinguish. You know, they're a little bit like drugs. You need a stronger and stronger dose over time. So you want to use them sparingly because the more you use them, the more terrifying you will have to be in order to get the effect you're looking for. And third qualifier is that how much fear people can tolerate depends on efficacy, depends on their feeling that they can do something about it. It is neither ethical nor effective to frighten people about something that they are or will feel impotent to respond to. So you, you know, you have to keep those qualifiers in mind, but with those qualifiers in mind, fear's a good one. You know, if you're not willing to do this, if you're not willing to manipulate needs, then your next best shot is to appeal to emotions. If you're not willing to do either of those, I wish you the best of luck. But you're really tying your hands behind your back. Number 8, and as part of my trying to sell fear, see fear arousal as a competition. I mentioned this earlier. People have as much fearfulness in their disposition as they have. You are competing with others who are trying to frighten them about other things. You know, the Christian right wants to frighten them about gay marriage, and I don't know, the Greenpeace wants to frighten them about global climate change, and you want to frighten them about flu. And if you do a good job, they'll be less worried about gay marriage and less worried about global climate change. And you have to worry about that, because if you do a good job of precaution advocacy on behalf of a second-rate risk, you may be stealing outrage away from first graders. You may be doing more harm than good. And there are probably people in this room who think that is an issue with regard to this pandemic. You know, there are certainly lots of people in health departments who think that that any number of chronic diseases like diabetes are more serious than the flu pandemic, and that this, you know, not only is it sucking your budget and your time, but if you are successful in arousing concern about flu, it's going to come from somewhere, and it may come from other health issues you care about more deeply. That is a real problem. On the other hand, you don't have to worry that you're going to turn people into quivering blobs of terrified protoplasm. I guarantee you, your messaging will have absolutely no effect on what people are like. They will remain who they are. And all you're trying to do is slice the pie differently, you know, and get more of their fear for your reason. Number 9, don't neglect emotions other than fear. What other emotions are useful in getting people to take precautions? Anger. Anger is a good point. No question about it. Environmental movement uses that a lot. And environmental movement uses anger more routinely than it uses fear to get people to demand precaution taking. What other emotions are available to you?
Empowered. Let them feel empowered.
Yes. Efficacy is very important in sense of control, very important in connection with fear, but it's a motivator on its own. You know, if the more power you feel, the more likely you are to exercise your power. What else?
Financial incentives,
but let's stick with emotions. Bribing people works. Absolutely no question that bribe, and this is another example of cognitive dissonance. If the bribe is big, it works, but it doesn't generalize. It doesn't produce information seeking. So if you're going to use financial incentives, as with needs, you want financial incentives that are large enough to motivate the behavior, but not large enough to justify it. Do you understand that? You see what I'm saying? In one of Festinger's studies essentially said, if you give people $100 to say something they don't believe, they'll say it, and when you ask them why they said it, they'll say, I did it for the $100. Maybe you need 500 now, and that was a few decades ago. If you give people $2 to say something they don't believe, you say, would you read this speech out loud for $2? A lot of people will read it, and then say to themselves, oh my God, I read that for $2? $2 is not enough to read that. I must believe it. It must actually have merit. The financial incentive of $2 produces considerably more attitude change than the financial incentive of $100. Everybody see why? Because $2 produces dissonance in information seeking, and $100 doesn't. It's a relevant need. I did it for the money, and there's nothing. You know, you get the behavior. Okay, but if you want it again, you're going to need another $100. You didn't get anything beyond the behavior. We're missing a couple of important emotions. One in particular, I'm waiting to hear about. What else? Guilt. Guilt is a good one. Guilt has had almost as bad a press as fear has, but guilt motivates a whole lot of behavior. I don't want to look like a jerk to my kids. This is very, very much a guilt-ridden feeling. What else?
You have a fear of family safety, kids safety, parents safety.
Yeah. If you're projecting the safety onto somebody else, it makes it more bearable in some ways, less bearable in other ways, and more actionable. We will all take precautions much more readily to save our kids than to save ourselves. You know, for myself, I say, but it's not worth it. You know, it's too much trouble. I haven't seen data on whether it works to say to young people with regard to the seasonal flu, get vaccinated for grandma and grandma's sake. You know, that this disease is for you, it's only a week of hell, but for your elderly relatives, it's extremely dangerous. It could easily kill them. Get vaccinated for their sake. You'll feel horrible if you give your grandpa a deadly flu. And that's working on guilt, and it's working on love. which is a biggie, and it's working on the whole family connection. And I'm seeing research on whether it's powerful enough to do the job, but you know, it certainly has a lot of theoretical appeal. And it's sound science, you know, at the same time, because that's actually what you are doing when a young person gets vaccinated against the seasonal flu is doing a favor for the elderly people in their life. Okay, number 10, give people things to do. We've talked some about the importance of things to do, particularly with regard to people feeling efficacy, feeling like they're not going to be paralyzed. Very, very fundamentally, whenever you're urging people to take precautions, you should make sure the precautions are actionable for them. What are some of the flu precautions we urge on people? Wash your hands, okay, and you know, as some of you know, the science about the connection between hand washing and flu is very, very weak. Flu is spread mostly by droplets, not mostly by fomites. It's not mostly spread by hand. But at least it's an easy thing to do. What else do we tell people to do? Cover your cough. Now think about that one for a minute. How actionable is that? Here I am, I'm in the subway, I've got my briefcase in one hand, and the other hand I'm holding the strap. Which hand am I going to cover my cough with? Often, it seems to me, we give people advice, and of course the flu advice that's least actionable is stay home for a few months. Even stay home when you're sick is extremely costly for people who, you know, whose employers are not going to give them pay for the days they stay home. But stay home because you might get sick is extraordinarily difficult advice to act on. We should be careful when we're giving people things to do, that we're giving them things to do they can do. Because otherwise, instead of increasing efficacy, we're decreasing efficacy. Number 11, give people choices of things to do. If you give people things to do, you're involving their ability to act. If you give people choices of things to do, you're also involving their ability to decide, their ability to think. And it's much more empowering to decide what to do than it is to just be handed what you ought to do. The conventional wisdom here, and I strongly support it, the research indicates that it's sound, is you normally want to offer people three levels of precautions. At least do X. X is the minimum. If you're an employer, you might say you have to at least do X. If you're a health department, you're likelier to be saying we recommend that you at least do X. We really want you to do X. Even if you think this issue is foolish, even if you think we're overreacting, please at least do X. We recommend Y. Y is more protective than X, and it's more hassle than X, and we think it's worth it. If you want to follow our advice, go beyond X, do Y. But if you think we're overreacting, all right, at least do X. If you think we're underreacting, if you think we're not doing enough or recommending enough, if you feel more vulnerable than other people, or you think this is more serious than other people think it is, do Z with our blessings. Z is more difficult than Y, it's more hassle than Y, it's also more protective than Y. We don't think it's worth it. We're not actually recommending Z. But if you're worried and Y doesn't seem like enough to you, Z, here's a list of Z's for you. Now the evidence, I'll take a comment in a second. The evidence suggests two benefits from having an X and a Z, not just a Y. One benefit is people are likelier to do Y when it's bracketed. Okay? When you give them options, and particularly one less protective option and one more protective option, then your recommended option becomes the moderate path and the favored path. You get more Y when there is an X and a Z than when there isn't. The other benefit is people who are going to do X or Z anyhow, people who are on the low outrage side of where you want them, or the higher outrage side of where you want them, people who are not outraged enough or too outraged in your judgment, And they're going to find their own path. It's not like you're the only one talking to them. They're going to find their own X's and Z's. If you are authorizing X's and Z's, when they do X or they do Z, they're still in your system. They haven't defined themselves as rebels. They haven't defined you as wrong. And they're much more open to your advice tomorrow or next week or next crisis. So for both of those reasons, I've got to stop again. For both of those reasons, you know, having an X and a Z is better than one size fits all. I have a very easy time convincing my clients, well, not easy, but a relatively easy time convincing my clients that there ought to be X's, that there should be less demanding things as fallbacks if people are unwilling to do the really hard things. Even that's a tough sell. I mean, what would be the X for vaccination schedule? It would be a lighter schedule where if you're not going to get all your vaccinations, okay, or if you're not going to give your kid all vaccinations, here's a schedule with only 2/3 of them. And that's our X. At least do that. If you're scared of too many vaxes, at least do the X. That's a tough sell, as you know, the CDC and most health departments refuse to have a backup for people who are afraid of vaccination. Your general position is you do all the recommended vaccinations or screw you. And I don't think that's a wise position, but I have an even harder time convincing people to have a Z. The Z for flu might be masks. Z for anthrax was getting your own prescription for Cipro just in case you needed it. And by and large, I mean, health departments are a little bit, I'm trying to think of a nice word for Nazi. A little bit authoritarian about these things, and they tend to think that, it's barely possible that we'll let people do less than we recommend, but how dare they do more than we recommend. And I urge you to have X's and Z's. All right, we have not covered the waterfront, but there's more on precaution advocacy in the handouts. There's more still on precaution advocacy on my website. So if you want more of this, there's a lot more where this stuff came from. Any comments or questions on the brief intro to precaution advocacy that I've given? Yes?
If the behavior change that you're seeking is easy enough, doesn't that reduce the cognitive dissonance so that people will just do it, even though, for example, with the flu, we're urging people to wash their hands? That's relatively easy. So if that person is not convinced that the seasonal flu, that H1N1 is really a big deal, that they'll go ahead and do the behavior change anyway because it's not hard.
Yeah, that's the risk, or that's one of the risks. What you do in order to avoid that problem is known in the precaution advocacy literature and the social marketing literature as the foot the door. Okay? In other words, when you give people easy things to do, much depends on whether you're helping them see that as the first step or whether you're helping them imagine that to be all they have to do. And I would want, when I say at least do X, I would want to say at least do X now. And then, regroup, rethink, see how things are going, see what your neighbors are doing, see what the news is, and see if you want to move on to Y. I wouldn't define X as all I want them to do. I would define X as I understand all they want to do now and see that as a first step. Does that make sense to you? I have urged a lot of clients, usually unsuccessfully, to frame the vaccination decision as we want you to decide yes. We want you to decide to get vaccinated. If you're not ready to decide to get vaccinated, our fallback is decide to wait to decide whether to get vaccinated. Getting to maybe is a whole lot better than getting to no. I think for people who are reluctant to move ahead, give them a place to perch. Where now the X is you agree that you might get vaccinated, but you're not ready, you want to wait and see how bad the disease is, you want to wait, you know, or in the case of seasonal, you want to wait and see if there is any seasonal flu this year, or if the pandemic crowds it out, and you want to wait and see if people are, you know, the early vaccinators are made sick, and then you'll make that decision. And you know, that becomes, you know, if it's done right, not a decision not to do it, but a foot in the door toward a decision to do it. Other comments? Yes?
We were talking about that at school, like, word for the disease, even at home, like, worst case scenario, if you relapse, maybe it's more from a communicator, we need to learn about the facts and why. And then, because you're here, here's what's going to happen if you don't get the shot.
I am confusing and I'm helping you confuse two things that are connected but separate, and I don't have time to separate them properly, but let me just tag the two, okay? One is giving people alternatives, including some that are less protective than your recommended option and some that are more protective than your recommended option. The other is doing your persuasion in stages, okay? So that you're asking for easy behavioral commitments before you ask for difficult behavioral commitments. Those are both true. They influence each other, so that, you know, intermeshing them requires some thought and requires more time than we have. But I want to make sure that they are at least conceptually separate in your mind. Other comments?